Blog Talk Radio.
Here we are. This week, Jim Phelps, Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett, and Fury's caretaker all died. Your question, what's he talking about? Kirstie Alley says that Scientology helps her lose weight. Okay, I don't want to ask a rude question, but is there some reason it wasn't helping when you gained it? New unemployment claims are down for the past week, as is the four-week moving average. If that doesn't seem like an improvement, you're employed. New Jersey authorities are investigating racist remarks made at Walmart. No, not in their offices, over the public address system. TV has come to the internet. Could the internet be coming to your TV? Google is searching for the answer. South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford has agreed to pay $74,000 in fines to the state after being charged with spending state funds and campaign funds improperly. The health care bill may pass the House this weekend. The total cost of $940 billion. What's that for you? $24.48 per month. Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, welcome to Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. That would be me. All of that, news of the weird, and a great guest for the evening, Professor Michael Wong, is going to join us to talk about making groundwater drinkable. It's actually much more interesting than it sounds, so stay tuned. You're going to be hearing him converse with us in the second half hour. Also, if you'd like to converse with us in either half hour, you can do so by calling in to 347-994-3796. And if you dropped your pen, I'll repeat it. It's 347-994-3796. And should you call in, we'll try to get you on. We're talking about politics, technology, economics, pretty much everything but religion and perspiration, I suppose. Before we get into the news headlines we highlighted, I wanted to tell you that if you are in business and you have a website and you're not blogging, you're probably missing the best thing you can do to drive eyeballs to your website and chase dollars to your bottom line. You can do it yourself for free, or you can have a professional writer do your blogging for you for under $100 a month. Modesty forbids me to tell you who that is, but you can go to jeffonblogging.blogspot.com and read about blogging services. Again, that's jeffonblogging.blogspot.com. Before we go into the rest of the headlines, I wanted to make note of the time. If you are listening to this program in archived edition, then you can, listen to us live, but for many of you, the time of the program has changed. It hasn't changed for us. We still record at the hour of 7:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. Mountain Time, which is where we are, but because we're in Arizona, we don't change to daylight savings time. The net result of that peculiarity is that though half the year we're on Mountain Time, the same time as Denver and other cities in that zone, the other half part of the year when everyone is on Daylight Savings Time, instead we're on the same time as California. So although we, again, don't change our time when we are broadcasting live, 7:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m., for those of you who are not in Arizona, the time does change. So if before you were listening to us at 7:30, now you're listening to us at 8:30. And if, for example, you're in California, Oregon, Washington, or Nevada, and you were listening to us previously at 6:30, now you're listening to us at 7:30. I hope that provides you with an idea if you're anywhere else in the country. But we begin our live program from now until the end of daylight saving time at 10:30 Eastern, and clearly that means we end at 11:30 Eastern. And for the rest of you, I'm afraid you're going to have to do your own computation. Let's talk about those headlines. we surfaced at the beginning of the hour. I mentioned Jim Phelps and Fury's caretaker. That's because I couldn't remember the name of the character. But Peter Graves died this week at the age of 83. And in addition to having served a term as the leader of the Impossible Missions Force on Mission Impossible, he was also the lead character on Fury, if other than the horse. For those of you who don't remember, Fury was a TV series in the 50s. I believe it was the late 50s. And the story featured the horse and Joey, his boy, as well as the character that Peter Graves played, which was Joey's uncle and the owner of the ranch on which Fury resided. That was the part that Peter Graves played. And Fess Parker died today. He was 85 years old, they reported, and I'll explain that in just a moment. He played Davy Crockett, famously, in the early 50s, and then in, I believe it was the late 60s, played in a TV series, the life story of Daniel Boone. I should say the fictionalized story of Daniel Boone, because although Daniel Boone, like Davy Crockett, was a real live human at one time, they both were rather glorified in the stories of their lives, in the case of Crockett in the Disney films and Disneyland episodes, and Daniel Boone in the case of the TV series. Nonetheless, they were both interesting, and Fess Parker played the parts. And to tell the truth, if you saw him playing Davy Crockett or saw him playing Daniel Boone, you wouldn't have been able to tell the difference. Both characters wore the coonskin caps with the odd-looking tail at the end. Yeah, it looked like a braid. And in any event, he died today. After he had been on those shows, he more or less retired from the biz of show and became a real estate developer in Santa Barbara. And I found out recently from a friend of mine that Fess Parker had developed some luxury mobile home developments in the Santa Barbara area. And since I'm in that field, not the luxury type, it was of some interest. But that was the story of Fess Parker. Kirstie Alley is now on a new diet program and has a new series coming out, and was on Larry King Live when she told him that this diet was going to make all the difference in the world for her. The last one didn't. She had been a spokesperson for one of the weight loss programs, and she lost a bunch of weight and then gained it back. Very often, as a side note, you'll hear people talk about how great a diet worked, and they lost a bunch of weight, and then they regained it. My own view is that if you gain a lot of weight after this great diet you're on, the diet didn't work. If the diet works, you take it off and keep it off. That's why, as a practical matter, diets don't work, and you really need a lifestyle change. But that's a different subject for a different day. In the Walmart store discussion, what occurred was in New Jersey, someone got on the public address system in a store and announced that it was necessary for all black people to leave the store. They are investigating this. They don't know whether it was one of their employees, called associates, or a member of the public who got access to the phones through which they could speak over the public address system. But whoever it was clearly peculiar, a racist, and obviously strange. But they felt they had to announce, once they had the public address system at their disposal, that all blacks had to leave the store. So everyone was, of course, appalled. I suppose probably not everyone was, but most people were appalled. And that's being investigated to find out who did it. If it was a Walmart employee, one of two things will happen. Either they'll get fired, or they'll get promoted and sent to the home office in Arkansas. But in either event, this was apparently something that people weren't expecting. South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, we announced that he'd agreed to pay fines, but without admitting any wrongdoing. He entered into a rather peculiar legal animal that exists out there called a consent decree. In a consent decree, you're accused of doing something, but without admitting it, you agree to pay fines and to never do it again. There are a lot of companies that do that in fraud investigations and in various kinds of SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission cases. But this was involving the use of state funds. In one case, he apparently, now he's not admitting this, but he apparently used first-class air travel to get to Argentina, which was his roundabout way of hiking the Appalachian Trail, if you remember. That's basically Governor Sanford. And the health care bill is going to be voted on Sunday, it appears, and it's not yet clear what mechanism is going to be used to pass the legislation, basically to pass the Senate's health care reform bill, health care financing reform bill. And the House leadership has considered using a mechanism called DEEM, D-E-E-M, and PASS, which is one in which a full roll call vote is not necessary, and the House votes to consider or deem the Senate bill passed with some changes that the House is passing along. It's all very esoteric and arcane, which is also the name of a law firm in San Francisco, but they are going to do something with the idea of passing this bill this weekend, and although as of earlier today they didn't have the necessary votes to do it, they are apparently confident that they're going to. President Obama postponed his overseas trip for a second time. The idea being, of course, he wants to be around when the bill passes, and you can't blame him for that because he's put in a lot of effort and political capital on that. Want to remind you again, if you care to join us, there is about 18 minutes or 13 minutes until Professor Wong joins us. If there's anything that we've talked about you'd like to talk about, or if you have some political axe to grind, preferably one agreeing with one of mine, please feel free to call, or you can disagree. That's okay, too. And again, that's 347-994-3796. As you can tell, perhaps my eye shifted off the phone number for a minute. I couldn't remember it. We are about to talk about News of the Weird. This is a website that we check about every week. And last week, because we were spending a lot of time on those news stories from then, we ended up not going over the News of the Weird. So I wanted to share some of those stories with you. And here we go. Thomas Allen Hugel, 56, of Sparta, Michigan, was running a business out of his home. That's not peculiar, of course, and not even a problem most of the time. But Mr. Hugel was, well, he was passing himself off as Dr. Hugel, and he was doing circumcisions in his home. Now, he also was doing piercings and massages in his home. But again, he was passing himself off as a physician. Now, if you needed a if you desired a circumcision and wanted to go to a doctor, would you feel at all uncomfortable about doing that in a home office? Okay. Well, half of the audience is now crossing its legs, and the other half is scratching its head. Speaking of audience, by the way, I wanted to thank those of you who have joined us recently. We've had a recent bump in our ratings. We're now up to 3 listeners, but seriously, we've had a bump, and I don't know if that's because you've joined us for a particular guest and have stuck around, or there's some other reason, but whatever it is, thank you very much, and we hope you decide to stick with us. Tonight, as I said, is going to be an interesting show. In coming weeks, by the way, before I go on to the next segment, we have, first off, after tonight, next week we have a city councilman joining us who the people in his town tried to bar from taking office after he'd been elected. And the week after that, we have an author we've just scheduled who has written a book called She Rain. And in an upcoming week, we are going to be rejoined by Larry Hancock, with whom we met last week, among other times, to talk about assassinations. And next time we're going to talk about the killing of Bobby Kennedy. So I think you'll find that interesting. So please join us each week. We have more guests being scheduled as we speak. Another story from the News of the Weird And if I didn't mention that website, it's newsoftheweirdalloneword.com. This next story comes out of Arlington, Washington. A 59-year-old man was driving his 1978 Buick when it left the road and careened down an embankment. It seems his steering wheel had come off in his hands. And when this story came out, the first thing that the number of people mentioned was that that's at least one thing that's never happened with a Toyota. Speaking of Toyota, it's going to come out. The question is not if, but when, in my opinion. It's going to come out that this has nothing to do with gas pedals sticking to the floor mat or faulty brakes. What is going to happen with the Toyota story is that sometime later this year is going to be made clear that there is a problem with the computer on board, and it is directing the gas pedal to continue acceleration, or if not the gas pedal, then the internal accelerator. There's clearly a problem with the program, and that's obviously going to come out, because the number of times that you've had acceleration problems with Toyotas just seem to be increasing, at least in the reporting of it, and it can't all be gas pedals sticking. As a matter of fact, my own mother had a problem with the Toyota that's not been part of the recall, and she didn't get hurt, but the car was damaged as a result of the unexpected acceleration. Going back to more news of the weird, Aralicia Bridges, 45, was charged, I'm sorry, you'll understand why I'm laughing in a moment, was charged in Atlanta with murdering her 26-year-old husband following a domestic altercation. Again, unfortunately, killings between husbands and wives do happen with some frequency, unfortunately. What makes this story a little peculiar is that Ms. Bridges is a registered lobbyist for an organization devoted to fighting domestic violence. Jermaine Bowman McDonald filed a lawsuit against a wig store in New York City. And I don't think we did this story about the mannequin head falling off on her foot. But if we did, we'll repeat it because it's so good. And if we didn't, then it's new for you. I know I told the story to someone else, but I don't think we did it here. She filed a lawsuit against a wig store in New York City based on an incident last July when a plastic mannequin head fell on her left foot. The nerve damage that resulted, she said, has left her unable to curl the toes of that foot. Her husband filed a separate lawsuit asserting that the injury had prevented their having satisfactory marital relations, meaning sex. Now, that's the end of the story, but you might be able to help me here, because somewhere in here there's got to be a joke about her receiving head from the mannequin, but I can't think of what that might be, so your help will be greatly appreciated. The other thing I wanted to report to you is the item we mentioned near the top about the health care bill, and we mentioned the cost, but I'd like to go over that again with you. At the risk of sounding like I'm trying to lecture you on math, let me go ahead and explain this. The health care bill, which has allegedly a cost of $940 billion, is also, by the way, scheduled or believed to be by the Congressional Budget Office to reduce the deficit after a few years by $138 billion a year. And I believe I have all those figures correct. The one I know is correct is the cost analysis, $940 billion over 10 years. So how does that break down? I'm glad you asked. If you take that $940 billion and you divide it by the number of years that it will be paying for it, according to the analysis, and this is not quite accurate anyway, but if you take that $940 billion, divide it by 10 for the number of years, you get $94 billion a year. That's the easy part of the math. Here's where you go a little further. When you take that $94 billion and you divide it by the estimated population of the United States of 320 million, that brings you down to $293.75 per year per person. That comes out, for your cost, $24.48 a month. That's assuming, of course, that we're actually paying taxes for that, which is an assumption which may not be true and is a whole different subject. But If we are actually paying for it out of pocket by paying taxes, it's $24.48 per month per person in the United States. The question is, and I think it, most people would answer yes, are you willing to pay that so we can make sure that a great many more people are insured? And are you willing to pay that knowing that your insurance company cannot exclude you for a pre-existing condition, cannot cap the amount of money they spend should you have a long-term serious disease, and cannot raise the prices so much on the insurance as a practical matter you can't afford it? $24.48 a month. That's it. And that's what all the fire and anger has been about. $24.48 a month. The reason I keep harping on that, of course, is because it seems pretty trivial when you're talking about the things that will be gained to spend $24.48 a month. You're welcome to disagree, and if you do, please give us a call sometime within the next 4 or 5 minutes, because after that we'll be having our guest on, who will be talking about a number of things, including groundwater treatment. The basic thrust of that, incidentally, is that there is a lot of polluted groundwater in the world, particularly in the third world. And if you come up with a way to treat that, you're obviously benefiting a lot of people, and that's what Professor Wong, I believe, has done. The subject of Kirstie Alley on this diet situation and Scientology. We were having a discussion last evening at a book club that I belong to, and since then I was speaking to my lovely bride about it, and there's a lot of discussion as to whether Scientology is a cult or a religion or none of the above, and I don't really have an opinion on it because I don't know enough about Scientology, and what I do know about it sounds, frankly, almost too weird to be a cult. Forgive me if that offends you, but I don't imagine, we probably have a lot of Scientologists listening to us anyway, but that's just a guess. But some of their belief system has to do with the Earth being created by people who came here from other planets or other galaxies. And in spite of all that, the guy who created Star Trek was not a Scientologist, so far as I know. And the thing that Kirstie Alley says is that Scientology has helped her lose weight. Oh, the primary thing I was going to say is that very often the difference between a cult and a religion is how many people have signed up. Once you get a certain number of people, you're no longer a cult. And the reason I say that isn't just to make the joke with regard to Scientology, but most religions have been accused at one time or another of being cults. To make matters worse, several cults have been accused of being religions. But the fact is that a lot of people, I don't, because, again, I have no dog in the race, but a lot of people consider Mormonism to be a cult. And there have been people who have thought various other religions would be appropriately described that way. Cult is never used as a positive description. Whenever someone is calling some group a cult, obviously it's a denigration, a put-down. And so whether Scientology qualifies for that or not, I don't know. But it does have some beliefs that seem peculiar to the rest of us. So do other religions to a large extent. If you analyze logically any religion's beliefs, it begins to break down. They begin to break down a little bit. I'm not trying to insult anyone's religion. And if you have one, congratulations, and I'm glad it makes you happy and comfortable. But the fact is, you have to acknowledge that a lot of things that are said in the Bible, if taken literally, for example, make no logical sense. That doesn't mean you are wrong for believing it. That's a matter of faith. But in terms of logic, the logic doesn't allow for religions per se to make a great deal of believable sense. But, of course, that's why they call it religion and why they call it faith. The thing we mentioned earlier about Google and television should be mentioned further. Right now, you can use the Internet to watch TV. And I, for one, have done that on a few occasions. In the sense that, for example, I'll occasionally watch Family Guy because I have very highbrow humor. I watch Family Guy on Hulu. I think it's Hulu, but in any event, one of the services or another. There are several services on which you can watch television episodes. And many people, of course, watch much more than that, and they're old movies. There are even old episodes of Dr. Kildare. Not on Dr. Kildare. What was it? There was an old... Yeah, on YouTube, yes. But you can, oh, right. So on YouTube, there were some old episodes of Dr. Kildare. So you can watch that on the Internet, on your computer. But what Google is trying to do in combination with Intel and, I believe, Sony, is create a set-top box so you can actually access the Internet on your TV. I, for one, am looking forward to that because I'd like to access Internet radio stations. Now, if my analysis of the phone information on my switchboard is correct, we have... If I can go ahead and get this to work. There we are. Professor Wong, are you with us?
That's me. This is Mike here, Mike Wong.
Okay. Professor Mike Wong is a teacher, a professor at Rice University in Houston. It is Houston, right? Where Rice is?
Very good. Houston, Texas.
That's the Houston I was thinking of. And there are a couple of things that he's done that I find fascinating. And one of them he's gotten a good deal of, a fair amount of publicity about, which has to do with treating groundwater. And we'll get into that in a minute. But you've also been involved in solar energy research, as I understand it, right?
Definitely, Jeff. That's a
okay,
lot of
good.
Interesting things one can do with nanotechnology.
Right. Well, we'll go ahead and get into that in a minute. But first, before we do that, tell us a little bit about your background in education and how you came to nanotechnology.
Sure thing. So I currently live in Texas, Houston,
mm-hmm.
Texas, and I've been working out of the chemical engineering department at Rice University for about 8.5 years or so now. And I am a chemical engineering professor, and I was educated in chemical engineering at the bachelor's level and the PhD level and the master's level at Caltech in Pasadena, California, and then for my BS, and then from MIT out in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And then before heading over to Rice, I did a one-year postdoctoral research position at UC Santa Barbara in the chemistry department, and that was a lot of fun.
I'll bet. Where are you originally from, California?
You know, it's kind of funny. I grew up in California, Northern California,
okay.
And Sacramento. I was actually born in Canada, so I've traveled quite a bit.
Apparently so. Well, you mentioned Pasadena. I spent most of my life in the L.A. area.
Oh, excellent,
so.
Excellent. How did you find the weather down there?
Well, now I live in Arizona, so the situation is LA and Arizona, the only difference is that here it's hotter and colder, depending on what kind of
Very
time of
good.
Year.
Yep.
But yeah, I'm sure you liked the weather in LA probably as compared to Sacramento.
It's very different climates, and I enjoyed both.
Okay. Very safe. My own experience of Sacramento is during the summer it was not only warm but extraordinarily humid. Almost like being in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, you're now at Rice,
mm-hmm.
and you're teaching. Are you teaching or strictly researching there?
I do both. I teach in the fall and the spring semesters subject matter in the chemical engineering area, and when I don't teach, I do research. I run a research program in the area of nano and catalysis and whatnot.
Okay, I already have in mind to ask you about catalysis, but I also wanted to ask you first. And now, I being a professor and teaching, you probably realize there are often people listening to you who start out from pretty much ground zero in terms of knowledge, and I certainly
mm-hmm.
qualify there.
That's right.
So let me ask you first, what is a quantum dot?
A quantum dot? Oh, wow, gosh, that's an easy question to start off with, Jeff.
Well, I'm asking because I don't know the answer. So
very
please.
Good, very good. No, so what quantum dots are essentially small bits of matter that are an example of which would be something made out of cadmium and selenium, and
okay.
so this material is a quantum dot cadmium selenide nanoparticle. And why we call it a quantum dot is because these particles are so small that these things start to behave very differently from a big chunk of cadmium selenide, for example.
Okay.
and quantum dots. If you're to
you
look
say
at
they
it,
behave, you say they behave differently. How do they behave differently?
Oh, I tell you,
by reason of their size.
Yeah, because they're so small, it behaves very differently, and for in many different ways. And the most easy way to think about it is that they're so small, they don't fall out. They just sort of remain kind of suspended in a in water or in an oil.
Okay.
That's probably the biggest thing. The second thing is that depending on what it's made out of, these nanoparticles, they can glow different colors. They can have different magnetic properties. And depending on how big or small these things are, they will be more magnetic or less magnetic, or they will glow different colors.
Okay. And those can be manipulated for a purpose that's, that is desired in terms of accomplishing a task or a goal?
Absolutely. Because we can control the properties of these materials by controlling just the particle size, as a chemist, I consider myself a chemist, you know, and I consider myself a chemical engineer also. If I wanted these nanoparticles to be more magnetic, I'm going to make them bigger. If I want them to glow a different color, I'm going to make them bigger or smaller. And so adjusting the size of these guys really gives us a nice knob to turn, as it were, to engineer the properties of these things.
Okay. And the reason you would want to make something more magnetic would be so you can attract metals?
Sure, yeah.
Essentially? Okay.
You know, there's so many applications for magnetic materials, and these magnetic materials, some of the really fancy applications are for, I can think of one example, gosh, if you make something that's more magnetic, maybe you can use it to sop up arsenic from water.
Okay, because arsenic, which is a poison, has in part metallic. It's essentially it's metallic.
You know, it's interesting. Arsenic will react with the iron oxide nanoparticles that would be magnetic, and once it reacts, it'll stick to the nanoparticle. And once it sticks to the nanoparticle, then what you do is to take a refrigerator magnet or something like that, and get it close enough to these nanoparticles. And guess what's going to happen? It's going to drag this arsenic laden nanoparticles out of suspension.
Right out.
And right out. And that's a way to get rid of arsenic from drinking water, for example.
That's great. Well, let's go right to drinking water, right to water, because that's an area that you have researched and have found something to essentially cleanse toxic groundwater. I don't want to use the word toxic. That may be incorrect. Polluted groundwater, right?
Sure.
Tell us what you've done in terms of the metals and the whole thing. What's that about?
Well, I tell you what, you know, the whole idea of available drinking water, you know, it's something that we take for granted very easily, you know, living in the U.S. And, you know, go to a water fountain out of our drinking, you know, just out of our faucets. I mean, you go to the store and buy your Aquafina or what you call it.
Yeah.
It's easy for us to afford drinking water. But, you know, there's the rest of the world that struggles to find drinking water on a daily basis. Usually, particularly for developing countries, a lot of people have to, you know, travel a long way to get water, and sometimes these waters are contaminated by man-made chemicals or naturally occurring things in water that you can't drink. You don't want to drink it. It's gonna hurt you, and it's gonna kill you eventually. So
a lot of dysentery and cholera. In the third world, is as a result of polluted groundwater, right?
Absolutely. You know, the things that can hurt you are bacteria, virus particles, man-made pollutants, which I worry about from a research point of view, and naturally occurring contaminants like arsenic. Arsenic is not man-made, but it happens to show up in groundwater if you pump too hard on the water source. And these things you just can't drink. But you know, if you don't have a choice, you're going
to
drink it.
Right. You got to drink it to survive, and then the survival may be shortened by reason of the pollutants that are now in your body.
Bingo.
Okay.
So where I come in is coming from the standpoint of, gee, you know, of all the pollutants that are in groundwater, you know, what's something that that really just gets on my nerve, you know, and that's man-made pollutants. And so things that are man-made compounds that end up in drinking water are such things like industrial solvents, dry cleaning fluids. That perk is exactly. It's a really good example of of one that ends up accidentally in drinking water, and people
right.
hadn't realized that it's been accumulating in drinking water until a couple of decades ago, and they said, you know what, this is not a good thing to do.
No, drinking PERC and other chemicals is probably not the best thing for us.
Probably not the best way to go to have in your water. And you know, different parts of the country have higher and lower amounts of acceptable level drinking standards. Drinking concentrations. And you know,
right.
the EPA has certain standards that they've set where if you're below that, you're okay. And there are many sites throughout the U.S. where the drinking water is not suitable for drinking, and so you got to get rid of it. You got to
right.
treat it, and that's where I come in. I said, you know, let's try to get rid of this contamination from water in a way
right.
that's different from what's being done currently.
Well, before you came up with this process, what was being done to reduce the contamination in drinking water?
You know, the current ways of getting rid of these contamination. Contaminants from water are there's two general ones. There are many other ones, but I'll cite two of them. One is called carbon adsorption. It's kind of
okay.
like the Brita water filter system in your
right,
in your
carbon filtering.
Bingo, you got it. That's the same idea, but multiply that by 100 or 1,000 times scale wise, and that's what you use to clean up drinking to clean up groundwater. And that's called
right.
carbon adsorption.
Okay.
And that works, and what's the problem, you might ask? And so the problem is, well,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you go back to the Brita water system, filter system, what happens after a couple of months after
right.
you use it on a daily basis
right.
to
it
that
becomes,
cartridge?
Right. It becomes full of contaminants and is no longer useful as a filter.
You got it. And that filter basically traps the contaminants so that you can drink the water without having to consume the contamination. But that filter is going to get saturated, it's going to get filled up, and so, you know, on that scale, you can just throw it out and buy a new one.
Right.
But what happens when everything is 10 times more, 20 times more, 100 times,
mm-hmm.
1,000 times well, greater in terms
right.
of volume? It's not as easy or cheap to get rid of this saturated, activated
carbon.
So what
right.
you got to do is you got to spend a little bit of money to replace it with some fresh carbon. Okay, then, you know, if you have enough money, you can pay for it. But then what happens to the thing that's filled up with all this contamination?
Right.
Either you bury it or you regenerate it, meaning you kind of
right.
get rid of the contamination that's inside this bed.
But the processes are expensive, I trust.
The process is not cheap, surely. And more importantly, what happens to the stuff that was in the bed, that was trapped
right.
in there? It's got to go somewhere.
Right.
It's going to go into the atmosphere, or it's going to get burnt
right.
into something that could be more noxious than the contamination that was originally in the water.
And, of course, add to greenhouse gases.
Yeah, you know, greenhouse gases, I think the scale of it won't be that much, but you're going to be generating a little bit of CO2 and
right.
CO, surely. So, you know, it's not a very good solution in the overall scheme of things. So that's the first approach, you know, and it's
right.
still being used today. And the second approach is to do what's called air stripping. You know, you
okay.
take some air, you know, and kind of blow it through the water, or you bring up the water and kind of mix it in with air. And what happens
uh-huh.
is that the contaminants evaporate into the atmosphere. That's great.
That's good.
Well,
it's good for the water. It's not so great for the air.
You got it. You take
okay.
it out of the water because it's very easy. It just sort of evaporates. But then what do you do now with all the stuff that's in the air?
Mm-hmm.
You know, people used to leave it out into the atmosphere and sort of vent it out there. But that's a no-go now. So what
right.
people do now, they trap the stuff that's in the air using activated carbon.
And then you're back to the same kind of
exactly
problem. You're
back to this, yes, exactly. So either way, you still have this problem of this contaminant that's just sort of moved out of the water, but now it's sort of stuck in either in the solid phase or in the gas phase. And so that's where we came in with our approach to try to solve this problem.
So what was that approach?
This approach is basically to take the idea of, you know, if you're going to try to treat the contaminants in one step, let's try to chemically break down the contaminants once and for all. So that
now,
when you say
break them down, you're talking about turning them into substances that are not contaminants anymore.
You got it. Can we chemically convert the molecule? You know, these chemical compounds are really just molecules, and they're really simple mm-hmm. molecules at that. But if you can break the bonds and turn them into something that's safer and not so noxious in
right.
one step even, then you don't have to worry about what happens to it afterwards, because what happens to it afterwards is that it's just going to be in a much safer form.
It's innocuous.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so catalysis was where we came in with our approach, you know. And so the idea is to take some nanoparticles of gold and palladium. These are two precious metals
right.
That we use that, when put together in our special way, allows us to turn PERC or to turn trichloroethylene or chloroform. Anything that's chlorinated actually turns out to break down quite easily using our special nanoparticles, and it breaks down into something that's safer than the original contamination.
Is that what the word catalysis means? That is to make that, to go ahead and break those bonds and bring them into a state of, if you will, innocuousness?
Yeah, you know, it's the right idea. Catalysis is the idea of accelerating the reaction. It's to get
okay.
things going that would not normally go as quickly.
Right.
And so from a chemical reaction point of view, you know, PERC is not going to become less innocuous by itself. It's
right.
just going to sit there and sit there and sit there until you drink it, which is not good. But if you throw in a little bit of gold and palladium, you don't want to lose the gold and palladium, so you bring the water that's contaminated with the stuff and kind of run it over these nanoparticles, then what's going to come out of this, you know, reactor unit or treatment unit is water that has no PERC, but has only ethane. And ethane is safe, and it's not going to kill you, it's not going to hurt you in the long run, and that's a much better alternative and a much ultimately cheaper way to treat
yeah.
it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you about the expense. Now, gold and palladium are precious metals, but at the
mm-hmm.
same time, I'm assuming from what you said, since they're nanoparticles, number one,
yep.
you're not talking about a huge amount of gold or palladium. You're talking about nanoparticles of each of those metals, and therefore you're not talking about a huge expense.
That's right.
Is that part of it?
Okay. That's exactly where we think that this approach can be a real working technology, because we don't use that much palladium or gold because it's so nano-sized, and because of what we found in our lab, that just a little bit of palladium plus a little bit of gold was enough to kickstart the reaction to be so fast that from a cost standpoint, it's going to be cheaper than some of the things that are out there now. And so that's one of the things that we're pushing currently in our lab is to prove this point out in the real world.
Okay, so that has not really yet happened in terms of it being what's the word I'm looking for? I guess field ready.
That's right.
Actually, go into those places yet.
This is, I would say, it's cutting edge in the sense that this information is so new that we haven't published anything on it, because we're still discovering new things every day. In fact, last week we found some interesting results about how palladium and gold can do certain things with the chloroform to make it even safer more quickly. And
oh, great.
And so it's exciting for us, and from the, you know, science endeavor of validating the results and publishing it, there is a little bit of lag time behind that.
Sure.
So, you know, we're working simultaneously to start testing real ground waters where there's real waters with chloroform that's already contaminated, for example, or PERC or trichloroethylene, to see how well it will work in the long run. And so those are ongoing tests now that hopefully by the summer we'll be able to say something more concrete.
Definitive. Now, I did not do that brilliantly in chemistry, so I have to ask the question, which may show why, but I'll ask it anyway. Am I correct in assuming that not all pollutants are chlorine-based?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
it is.
If that's true, will this have an effect on those others?
That, you know, that's where being at in the lab every day, trying different ideas out, really becomes very handy to test some of these ideas out. And I tell you what, you know, a lot of the contaminants that are out there now are chlorinated, and they're also fluorinated and they're brominated. And from a science point of view, we think we have a great shot at tackling all those contaminants.
But at this point, you're not absolutely certain yet.
Well, I would say that's the nature of experimentation. That's exactly right. I would say there's a number of things that we found that gives very strong promise and hope. But as a scientist, I don't want to say anything until I validate it in triplicate, basically.
Sure.
But I'll go ahead and say that I'm very confident that we're on the right track and showing that this bimetallic nanocatalyst idea also works for non-chlorinated compounds.
Okay. Now, in terms of what you were saying, the water is run through a device that has these nanoparticles of golden palladium in them.
Mm-hmm.
And they are made innocuous by the process, and those pollutants, unlike the carbon situation, if I understood you correctly, are not trapped anywhere. They are basically rendered moot, if you will,
mm-hmm.
by the treatment.
That's
so
right.
There's nothing else that has to be done with them. Once it goes through the process, it is, at least for that amount of water that's treated, it's done.
That's right. That's essentially the idea, is that, you know, the molecule that's contaminating the water, you know, by itself is something you don't want to ingest. And so the question
right.
has been and will be and will continue to be, how do you turn that, how do you get rid of that from water? And so
right.
and so if we can chemically turn that into something that's just something that is going to be safer for the environment, then you're going to be on the right track as far as cost effectiveness and efficiency, and that's where catalysis really can play a strong role in cleaning up the water environment.
Right. And when this thing is ready to hit the ground, or the water as the case may be,
mm-hmm.
will it be like in a machine that the water would be going through to treat? And if so, is that something that's going to be, I guess, what's the word I'm looking for? I guess exportable and affordable in the places where it's needed.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's one of the things that we think about every day, which is how do you turn this interesting science discovery into a working technology? And so
right.
it's a difficult thing to do for most new scientific discoveries, as it were.
Sure.
But for something like this, you know, with so much, I would say, that's at stake, I think it's worthwhile to push this thing through. And where things are at is, probably the best way to get this thing out into the field is to be able to make sure that the nanoparticles don't float out, they don't escape into the environment. Things will be safe anyway, but you just don't want to take that chance.
Sure.
And so you're going to be thinking about a unit where you can port this to the contaminated site,
right.
have a pump that will then pump the water from the groundwater system underground, and there's
right.
many... many systems that are out there are spread out across the U.S. You
right.
pump the water above ground and send it through this unit, and this unit
and
will just turn that into cleaner water, and that water, you could do whatever you want to do with it. And the idea would be to, by default, to pump it and release it back underground, back into the water table.
Okay, dumb question. Would this have any effect or be of any value once it's in a unit that can be utilized in terms of oil spills?
Completely
outside the range.
Oh, well, that's a very creative question there. And, you know, it's...
creative question in this context means it was even dumber than I thought.
There are no dumb questions,
okay.
especially this time of the night, right?
Yeah, that's right.
No, it's a great question, and I say that seriously because... the idea that you can take a stream of contaminated water through a system one pass
mm-hmm.
and out comes cleaner water is a very strong and, I would say, a very attractive idea.
Sure.
And how well it will work will depend on the catalytic material. So we've been working
right.
with palladium and gold for a while now. And on the thing you want to get rid of.
Sure.
The question here is, will the contamination, in this case here, oil, be something we can catalytically convert into something that's safer? I would say that it depends on the level of concentration.
Okay.
If we're talking about an oil spill where you can actually see the spill, I think it's probably cheaper and easier just to scoop it out of the water.
Okay.
But now if we're talking about a contamination level where you can't see the oil spill, but you know it's kind of dissolved in the water.
By chemical analysis, you know it's there.
Right. Sure, or you can smell it, you know. You don't have to see the oil spill to know that it's there, you know. A lot of
went to school in Santa Barbara. You know about oil.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
It's you know, there's things that you know shouldn't belong in water if you can smell it but not see it. And so that's the type of things that I think a catalytic approach can be very useful for.
Okay, now we have about 8-9 minutes left, and is there, if someone wanted to know more about this, just as a matter of curiosity, because you know, if anyone's still listening to us, and I'm sure there are people who are, but if anyone is still listening to us, they're doing it because they're interested in the subject. Is there a website or an article or something they could read for further information that we're not going to be able to cover in the remaining time we have? Because I also want to ask you about the other subject we were going to talk about.
Sure, definitely. The best way to do it is as easy as it is nowadays is to Google the topic water treatment gold palladium, and that should provide a couple of hits that will lead to some papers. A more direct way is to go to the Rice University website and look up my webpage. My webpage is surfable. It's searchable through the Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering Department. And on my website, there's a number of scientific papers and some general descriptions about this water treatment technology.
So the way they would begin is by going to rice.edu?
Bingo. www.rice.edu. And search for Michael Wong, W-O-N-G, and that'll get you to the
where you need to go.
Exactly.
Okay, now changing subjects, but I'm not sure really how much of a change it is, because I think it also uses nanotechnology research. Is your work in connection with solar energy?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Sure. The definition of nanotechnology really is. Encompasses many different areas, and that includes the application areas of environmental protection, biomedical engineering, alternative energy production, and so solar cells fall quite into that category quite easily. So from where I sit, the things that I do have to do with materials and nanomaterials and how do we make it better. And how do we use it for applications that are important in engineering? So it's not that hard of a stretch to go from water cleanup to alternative energy production. Solar cells is a great example. I'm not the only one who works on this, and there's a lot of smart people out there who does it. And where my contribution comes in so far has been to look at how do you take quantum dots and to turn them into something that can be useful for electrical energy production from the sun.
Mm-hmm. Does this start off from the problem of efficiency of photovoltaic cells?
That's a great starting point to think about. The use of current photovoltaic cells basically relies on silicon solar panels, and we see this all over anywhere you would live. And that's sort of the first generation type of solar cells. There's another generation of solar cells. They're called the thin film solar cells, and those work also.
Mm-hmm.
Really, there's a lot of solar cell technology that exists out there now that does work to turn solar energy into electrical energy.
Sure.
The big problem is cost. How do you get this thing cost efficient? And so that's where government subsidies come in handy, and that's where a lot of research now is going into, which is how do you make the current technologies more cost efficient? So how does it connect back to nanotechnology? Well, I think the basic idea is, can at least from where I stand, is how can we turn quantum dots and put them into a solar cell configuration that allows us to turn solar energy into electrical energy with a higher efficiency on a cost basis.
And in part, is that because you can take those dots and manipulate their properties in order to increase the efficiency of the transference of the solar power into the electricity?
A big part of it. That's a real big part of it. One of the things that, when it comes to cost, one has to account for how you manufacture the stuff.
Sure.
So for silicon solar cells or for the thin film solar cells, one has to build into the cost of things the manufacturing plants that will be used to manufacture these large panels. Okay, so there's a large infrastructure that needs to be built before you ever spit out your first solar panel. Fine.
Right.
With quantum dots, the big and the most attractive feature of this is that you don't need this big fabrication facility to make these quantum dot-based solar cells. You don't need that. All you need, you just need a lab. You need a way to make lots of these quantum dots, and the quantum dots that I make are spherical shaped, but the ones that really work well to do the energy conversion are four-legged particles that people call tetrapods.
Okay.
These
tetrapod meaning 4 feet.
Bingo.
Yeah.
I call it four-legged particles. Sometimes I call it four-armed particles.
Okay.
And these things are clearly not spherical, but you can imagine them to be a spherical particle with four legs or four arms that kind of stick out from the center. And so it looks like a nano jack.
Okay.
And so now you have these particles now on the nanoscale, and you want to throw this thing into a thin film mixed in with a polymer that does some of the solar light capture. And once it captures the solar energy, it takes that energy and turns that into electrical energy. The big challenge is not so much how do you get electricity out of it, but how do you increase the efficiency just enough so that when you combine it with the cost of manufacture, that it'll be overall cheaper than the silicon solar cells.
Both in terms of the manufacturer and in terms of utilization.
Mm-hmm. The biggest sells for quantum dot-based solar cells are, number one, the much cheaper mode of manufacture when it gets to that stage, number one. Number two, you know, these quantum dot-based solar cells are not going to be brittle. They're going to be pretty pliable, actually.
Sure.
And, gosh, you have a solar cell that you can bend and twist and whatnot. You know, there might be some pretty creative things you can do with a bendable, non-brittle, non-breakable solar cell.
How about putting them on the roofs of cars?
You got it. Anything that's kind of curved, maybe, you know?
Right.
Maybe it might be a simple thing to slap on a curved sheet of solar cell. Maybe you can weave this into some clothing. Maybe you can slap this onto a non-flat surface, maybe on a light pole or something like that. You can get pretty creative with it once you kind of realize, hey, you know, we're not limited by the brittleness of current solar cells.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or the flatness of these current solar cells.
Right. Well, we have about 3 minutes left. and
I'm
the reason I'm laughing is I don't know if you've had the same experience, but this has gone by very, very quickly for me.
Indeed.
Yeah, and of course, one of the reasons it's gone quickly for me is because I've asked one question and then you start explaining, and I have nothing to say, you know, because it's beyond. I mean, it's just that answering the question is almost like a little mini lecture in a positive way.
Well, I appreciate the question, and certainly it's a lot of fun for me to describe some of the things I do from my lab, but fire away for the remaining few minutes.
Yeah, well, what I was going to say is it sounds like you really enjoy your work, obviously.
It's a lot of fun.
And the thing is that this has it's not ready to port it out yet, from what you said, but it's got some very important real-world applications, and particularly in terms of the solar stuff. If that can be done and done quickly, and as I said, you could power cars like that without the necessity of even plug-in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when that time comes, you're going to essentially have a revolution in terms of everything that happens with the oil-based economy. But anyway, we have a minute left, so that gives me just enough time to say thank you.
You're very welcome.
And I've really enjoyed it. I really do appreciate it. And I know that everybody who has joined us has enjoyed it as well. And if you want to see more about Professor Mike Wong's work, you can do it at rice.edu. And thanks very much. I really appreciate you joining us.
Jeff, it was a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you, Mike.
All right, good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
And with that, we have probably about half a minute left, giving me the opportunity to thank all of you for listening and asking you to join us next week at the same time if you wish to join us live or archive anytime, the same web address. And want to thank our wonderful producer, Autumn Leaves Bushman, who left her post about 20 minutes ago, but nonetheless, that was it. So thanks very much. Hope you join us again next week. Listen to us in archive version anytime. Thanks, and have a great week. Bye-bye.